I'm Amy.
I'm Wendell.
And I'm Patrick.
And
this is
Yes
But Why
Podcast.
Yeah, they got
would you
this
care?
Far
I wouldn't have cared.
They got they got to 85 years by being the same asshole they were for that
whole
time.
Sure.
Know? So, yeah, at least you don't have, like, the pressure of having to, like, mold a person, you know?
Like, you know, that is an interesting thing, actually, the idea of, like, how you can be an asshole for your whole life and it doesn't actually matter. That's the hardest thing, I think. We were talking about parenting earlier. That's the thing that really worries me is, like, how do I convince him without couching it in religion and this, like, hellfire thing? No, it's better if you're a good person. I know that it seems that if you're a bad person, you're going to get all the things that you want, and you will. But don't be that person, because it's just way worth it in your soul way. You'll feel better if you're a good person. If you're a bad person, yeah, it's true. You could be rich and famous and attractive and all the things. But, I don't know. So it's a hard lesson.
Well, I think defining bad person is a really difficult thing, too.
Because
a lot of people think about what they're doing for their families as opposed to, or religion, as opposed to what I'm doing to someone else. And you can really, you know, if you're a bad person, you're probably defining a lot of people as bad people so that nothing matters, you know?
Sure.
And the scapegoat of, like, saying, on my deathbed, I'm going to ask for forgiveness from God, and I'm going to go to heaven.
Sure.
Like, if you truly believe that shit, I guarantee 90% of those people were shitty up until the last 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Sure. And then they just say sorry and they're out.
Yeah. Oddly enough, I didn't, like, feel a pressure to be a good person until I stopped. Until I left the church.
Huh.
Yeah, because the way the model was set up to me, it was like, I'm a good person for, like, the moral desert of it all. You know, like, for the idea that, like, being a good person pays off somewhere down the line.
Yeah.
But, like, there was also, the escape route of saying, I'm sorry. When I decided that, or when I came to the conclusion personally that maybe that's not what's going to happen, all of a sudden the pressure was on me to, like, say, like, well, why am I alive? Is it to ruin everybody else's day all the time? Or is it to, like, just be a good person because it's all right? And also, I watched a lot of anime, and that kind of shit teaches you to work out. Like, I don't know. I was going to say, like...
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. If you're going to follow, like, an anime protagonist, they're all good for no reason. They're all, like, good despite many reasons to not be.
Melodramatic?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Get them on soap operas, anything like that.
Yeah, that seems right. Yeah, Days of Our Lives. That's what we'll start watching.
Yeah, like Captain Planet, you know, like cartoons. Like,
That's true.
I view my life in a narrative anyways. Even though there's no reason to do that, but, like, I just, like, I think about my life like a TV show or a movie or something.
So melodrama?
Yes, 100%.
So evil people are evil without much care?
No, I mean, like, I definitely don't draw things, like, black and white, necessarily, but, like, as far as, like, what I need to think about myself to consider myself to be, like, a good protagonist as opposed to, like, the antagonist of everybody else's story, is to, like, make good decisions despite there being no real payoff to it, you know? Like,
yeah.
I feel like that makes a good decision more valuable is that, like, I just did it because it...
It also sounds really exciting to think that you're on a journey to a... battle.
Right.
To a final, like, decision, you know?
Yeah.
I think we all think of our lives in a narrative way, though.
Don't speak for me.
I do. What do you think?
Oh, God.
Is it all just, like, the numbers?
I don't
and
even know.
Things of it?
Yeah, it's just all ones and zeros.
Yeah, just the matrix.
I'm a code guy.
Yeah, that seems right.
God, life. Shit. I don't know.
Sorry, to open with the deep.
Yeah, we didn't have to, like...
We just jumped right in there,
sorry. We built to life.
I mean, we started out with a bit about being mean to old people. I thought maybe we were right there.
Speaking of life, I'm going to dip into this box of chocolates here. Maybe anybody is... I feel like there's some correlation.
I'm gonna not get into politics, but that was my next thing, my answer about life, which I'm not gonna say. So
that's cool.
Your that answer about sometimes. Life had to do with politics?
Right now.
Interesting.
I think my reasons for a lot of the energy that I emit, which we all know negative energy is really exhausting, and mm-hmm. I think personally that I'm going through a lot of sleep problems and stuff like that.
With related to the political mm-hmm. landscape?
Interesting. Like in an insomnia way, like you're losing sleep over it.
In a way of, it intersects with my personal like relationship with my wife. She's from Iraq, and she's only been here for 2 years. Her sister's here. So like that, all of that makes me constantly envision what Texas or America will look like in 5 years.
Mm.
And if we want to have a child, I want to have a child so bad.
Yeah.
And I worry about what this place looks like in 5 to 10 years.
You know, it's interesting. I actually have a theory that, that the 50 states, or rather the 48 contiguous, will become multiple countries before the end of my lifetime. That right now, the big swath of land that is our country, it's impossible to truly represent all the different cultures. I mean, we're all from very different places. We're lucky that the three of us can have a conversation because what we grew up with are all much different things. And in ways we don't even understand because we only know our own experience, totally. Like everyone.
Mm-hmm.
But so due to that, one of the reasons why I've decided to stay in Texas is I think Texas is safe. I think Texas is if stuff goes down, that I feel like Texas should be okay.
I feel like a lot of infrastructure be the last to go. I don't know if it's like bulletproof necessarily, but I think it will be.
No, I think it's not bulletproof because it's very much a target. Yeah. But at the same time, I think that people around here are, you know, like want to take care of each other, and you know, when the shit hits the fan, I really think people will.
See, back I always each thought that about up. South Carolina.
I found that way with a lot of people, but I don't know.
I always thought that about South Carolina, just because who gives a shit about South Carolina? That was always my thought. Was like if
you're on things the coast. Start
to pop off,
yeah.
But there's like literally no military value to it, and also it's. I always thought of it like kind of like Russia in World War II, where it's like a weird landscape that like the people that live there understand it very well. So like it'd be like a Red Dawn scenario where just everybody knows to go to the hills, and like it would be well defended to a certain extent. And also nobody like there's not only no military value, there's just no value to having South Carolina in your pocket at all. So like I was just like, this would be a great place to figure a plan out at least. You know, like, shit will pop off and then major cities will go down. And barring the idea of, like, fallout reaching South Carolina to some extent, like nuclear fallout or something, I feel like that would just be a good like place to, like...
Nuclear is a totally different situation.
You're describing what I think of West Virginia.
Oh, yeah, no, that's literally...
Yeah.
Same.
Right, yeah, it's one state over almost.
Where are you from, Anthony?
Muncie, Indiana.
Huh.
3.5 hours southeast of Chicago.
Right on.
Wow.
I am...
Yeah, I don't understand what that's like. Wendell's always talking about South Carolina. I, 100% of the time, only imagine the 80s movie Shag. That's all I know of South Carolina.
I don't think I've ever seen that.
It's a good one. But,
yeah, that's the state dance.
But it's a... it's like set in the 60s. It's real fun.
Yes, yeah, they two-step here. We shag in South Carolina.
It's real fun. But it literally is a movie, you know, of course. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know anything about Muncie, Indiana, except for I believe it's mentioned a number of times in...
Parks and Rec.
In a lot of things.
And in plays and musicals and whatnot.
Because
yeah.
It was declared as the census, like, center of America in the 50s. It represented what everyone thinks in America, right? So.
Yeah.
It's in the Hudsucker Proxy. It's they mention it a million times in The Simpsons. They like it's just a reference point for who's boring, and it's not that boring because it's got a lot of issues. Surprisingly violent, but I think back in the 50s, it was a really great industrial, like little isolated pocket of industry with Warner Gear and just a couple other foundries that popped up there.
I don't necessarily know that like boring is a bad thing though. Like I always think about that, like going from a small town to even a place like Austin where it's just like people are doing stuff. It's like complexity is fun, and I think it's like it's engaging and it's good to like. If you don't feel satisfied in your lot in life, then, like, throwing yourself into a more complicated environment is a good way to, like, at least be pushed in a direction. Whereas, like, you know, like a small town in South Carolina or in Indiana that doesn't necessarily have a whole lot going on or, like, this big push, I think, like, there's merit to that in other ways. You just have to, like, value it in a certain way. Like, I miss simplicity a lot sometimes. Like, I do. I don't know. It's like, I don't necessarily miss it, but I do, like, understand why everybody in South Carolina stays where they are.
Because I don't think that either the people that live in your town in South Carolina or the people that live in Muncie, Indiana think their lives are simple. I really don't. I think that every human being thinks that, I think every human being thinks that their own life is complicated in as much as they can handle. And I think you're right. I like what you say about going to a more complicated place to give yourself a path. Heck yeah, absolutely. Yeah. If you're a kid who's grown up in a small town and you're like, oh my God, why? Then go to a bigger place but work it slowly. Don't jump to New York City. Do not jump to New York City. Everyone who's listening, don't jump. It's step four. It is not step one. Mm-hmm. Because it's humongous and too much. And you're right. Somewhere like Austin seems good. That being said, I don't really think about Muncie. What's the size of it? Like, you said it's... I noticed you said surprisingly violent. Does that mean it's a city that has a lot of crime in such a way that it affected you?
Well, now I'm so far removed, I'm wondering if that's true anymore. But, so, Ball State... If you've ever heard of Ball State, it's like 20,000. It's a pretty decent-sized university right in the center. So I think Muncie is about 60 to 70,000. And there are just inequalities all over the place, and it's really complicated in a racial way. And super isolated. I personally am super... proud and privileged to have gone to a very, very, very mixed school. So the richest kid in the city went there, as well as like it's 30% African American, and there's not too much of a Hispanic population, but they were at my school. So just interacting with that, I know it sounds stupid to say, but I don't know many people who went to a super mixed school.
Yeah.
High school, and middle school. So that shaped me a lot. Super proud of that. So when I went to Chicago, things were a little different for me.
Yeah.
I don't think I was as scared of people because of that. But I also saw a lot of, like, fucked up violence in high school, too. So, you know, there's two sides to it.
Yeah.
But I think jumping into Chicago was the best thing I ever did. Like I told you before we started recording, New York was a way too much for me, but I also think New York has become a lot, like, exponentially more difficult to navigate financially and mentally than it used to be. And if in the 80s and 90s, everybody was flooding to New York and having a great time, and you could actually just make above average money and live there, then what a great place, right? But
well,
now you're, I mean...
From what I understand, the 80s and 90s in New York were, like you mentioned, terrible. quite violent.
Well, I've read
a lot of stabbing
about the this like the late 70s and early 80s. That's a really fascinating time and place.
Yeah.
Just yeah, the subway system and all the scams going on. It's just if you're into reading, there are some. I think it was called The City's on Fire or something like that.
Oh, just about like the people that worked in the city system.
Just about New York sort of collapsing at that time.
Huh, interesting.
And subway systems breaking down. What do you do when you've got 9 million people relying on public transit and it doesn't go?
It is 9 million, by the way. I looked it up the other day. Isn't that crazy?
And there's only like 10 cities in the whole U.S. that have a population of over a million. So see, it's like...
I thought it was 13. Is that greater, maybe?
13. I'm sorry, million? What? 13 million is greater than 9 million,
no,
but no.
Greater New York.
Oh, I don't know. I literally looked up population New York, New York City, and I'm assuming that the population it gave me included all five boroughs. Like, not just the Nine Mile Island, not just Manhattan. Though the idea that even a fraction of that that 9 million is small on this area. Tiny little island.
Yeah.
Even Long Island and the Bronx and Staten Island are tiny places.
Yeah.
They're not big.
Yeah.
It's called Long, but it's like, okay.
You want to know what's fucked up to think about?
Yes.
How many people you think are in Tokyo?
Ooh, you know the right answer, right?
Yes,
okay,
I do.
Okay, cool, because I can't handle not knowing right now.
It's
let's
not
see.
A big place either.
Maybe 13 million, because you mentioned 13 million, so I wondered. How many?
20? Am I undershooting it still?
Yes.
Oh wow! God. All right, wow. 40 million.
36.
36 million people?
In Tokyo. They sleep in fucking pods.
Yeah. Yeah.
No wonder they sleep in pods.
Yeah, no, I...
Jesus! Wow. You know, I find it very interesting. So, so to the idea of that you mentioned earlier, of the idea that smaller towns would be simpler, I think the idea of it is not simple versus complicated in the way that we deal with our lives. Because everybody's got to pay bills, and everyone's got to get a job, and everyone's got to date, and everyone's got to get married and deal with other people. That part is complicated for everyone, no matter how many other people are around
personal,
you.
Yeah, personal complication is
but,
one of the things.
But yeah, when you think about just the sheer number of human beings, because something that's really interesting to me is the idea that we are all still animals. And I swear we'll bring this around to theater because I connect this idea in my head, though, which is like, we are all animals. We all have visceral reactions, and cities are often mob mentality the whole time. Like whenever I went to New York City, I'm from Boston. Whenever I took the train in or the bus in to New York City, I could feel, as I got closer, I could start to feel the energy of all the human beings right around each other, right there. And it would feel different. Like I could, there was a buzzing that would inhabit me as soon as I crossed the border. And I think it's just because human beings, when they get near each other, we physically have an energy that connects. Same where, you know, a riot can become mob mentality. People who are like, that person's never done that in their life, but they're lifting flaming trash cans into the sides of buildings. Like, they're just taken over by the swept up. And I wonder in larger cities how that works.
Yeah. Like, you could win a football game and tear your city apart just as bad as you losing a football game.
Yeah.
There's a really interesting study that I wouldn't be able to reference or look up because it was probably 2009. They studied the rhythm of cities by recording footsteps and conversations just randomly throughout the day. And they could find like very obvious patterns of the way people would start to speak, stop to speak, start to walk, stop to walk. And they boil it down to like subconsciously everybody's plugged into the larger animal. And it was really shocking.
So is it consistent in big cities, or is it different in regions?
As far as I remember, they just did big cities.
Okay, okay. So, I mean, but I mean, it changes city to city?
Or yes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Drastically. Okay. Right, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Makes me think of, like, beehives or, like, anthills. Like, that group, that grouping has their own rhythm of how they accomplish their task.
Mm-hmm.
And every city, Chicago, New York, you know, Austin, has their own rhythm in which to do it.
Yeah.
Sometimes I think it's really just a matter, and the beauty of us living in an age where it's like you can grow up in Indiana and live in Texas or whatever, is that like, yeah, you can just go find the city that feels most comfortable to you, because you're like, oh, this rhythm is the right rhythm for me.
Totally.
I've often picked places to move viscerally. Like, I've gone to a place and been like, yeah. So tell me, first I want to hear about you moved to Chicago. You moved to Chicago after college.
Mm-hmm.
What did you go there for? What did you do? Tell me about your adventure while you were there.
Straight to Second City. I just wanted to do comedy. I had started doing like this really absurd sketch two-man stuff for stand-up in Indianapolis. And it didn't really fit in, but we kept doing it, and it was super fun, and I just thought, I want to do sketch comedy. So I went straight to Second City. And this started that whole thing of, like, going to all the theaters and performing and taking classes and your friends and your drama. All that same shit everywhere, right? So spent most of my time doing... I started thinking about this on the way over here because I assumed we would be talking about this.
Yeah.
So, I learned narrative, stage presence, and story through improv. And that feeds so many people when they're writing sketch. I'm not sure how many people are so developed. Like, I don't mean developed, but, like, my formative years were all informed so much by improv, and I was a writer the whole time. For some reason, I just never really got into it. So then, when I started writing plays, which would have been, like, year 6 or 7 after, you know, all that improv, I started writing plays as if it's not okay to have supporting characters. So everybody had, like, huge wants and really strong points of view, I guess.
Sure.
And so I wrote a couple full-length plays, and I was like, they were really fun. They did well, but I could tell that, you know, story's hard to accomplish, or hero's journey or whatever is hard to accomplish when everybody is big time. So
yeah,
I went to grad school.
That's also, like, more fun too, right?
Way more fun.
Yeah, way more fun to just give every character a life, right?
Mm-hmm. And if you end up directing, you realize that even more so, right? Because there's something you can see on an actor during rehearsal when they are not, like, supercharged as a character.
Right.
And it happens. It's happened since the beginning of writing, right? And you just have to accept some people take these smaller roles and they work their way up to the lead or whatever. But it still bothered me, because in improv, that is much more of a no-no, you know? So I just always wrote like that. And then I went to grad school where... they're structured Nazis, where, like, literally, if your intrusion doesn't happen on page 10, you're not graduating, type of shit, right? So
grad school in Chicago?
No.
Okay, so.
Ohio, Athens, which is right as the app start.
Okay. Gotcha.
Yeah. So grad school is really great. That was a really complicated situation. So when I think about, like, complexities and simplicity, Chicago is so anonymous that things are pretty simple in that way day to day.
Okay.
But, because it's so big?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And because no one gives a shit.
Right.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're in Athens, Ohio, it's everybody's in each other's shit. And that was a hard thing to me to figure out.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
You don't think it had something to do with the fact that, like, you were at a grad school, so there was, like, a faculty in charge of, like, checking you out and watching you and being all on top of you? It was, everybody was like that, not just that crowd. Just, like, it was, like, just the, what the town was like.
Yeah.
What you just described was, I mean, it was really hard for me to deal with somebody who was all over me about what I was doing every time.
Yeah.
That being said, we had to write a play every Friday, cast, direct, and put it up on stage for 3 years. And that was challenging, but...
Wait, you wrote a play a week for three years?
5 to 10 minutes, yeah.
Well, that's an excellent exercise. Okay.
Oh, and it was always a prompt. Like, it is literally a brilliant structure for learning how to treat your writing as if it's writing and not your soul that you're plotting out.
Yeah.
Which I never understood that concept until a year and a half into it, right? So once we really started to be able to talk about each other's plays, and some people never did get there. Honestly, there are people who will never be able to look at their work and objectively, you know.
That's so interesting.
But it's always in front of people, and because it's grad school, and because we put a lot into it every week, we always had an audience. So I have like 80 short plays that have been tested in front of an audience. And the next Monday, we sit down and we write out our critiques of every play and go through that shit. And it, I mean, the amount of stuff that came out of that is just amazing.
Wow.
But our teacher was a hardcore.
So the micromanagement came from within your like peer group.
It was definitely empowered by the teachers, instructors. But once again, at the time, it felt like it's working against my creativity, right? Like, what are you doing putting my voice in a box? But they always wanted us. I mean, we were so active with updating our artistic statement, and which I thought was super corny for the first 2.5 years, right? But doing things like that taught me so much about what I was doing that you would never know about yourself. I found out that the way that I write, like, a long-form play is when I've fucked up really bad in my life, I made one decision, and I usually go back to that decision, and I just completely unpack it, and pack it, unpack it, pack it, and I write maybe five to ten drafts, and then I'm halfway there to figuring out, oh, this play is about the fact that I think I might be depressed, you know, and trusting my process instead of having a goal became my path, because I write really, really, really shitty at the beginning, and being able to show that to people is a really hard thing to do. But not after school, you know?
Yeah.
Now I know that my process is figuring out the moment that I made a decision that I've always regretted. And it always happens. I can't explain it.
That's your catalyst for writing. That's what, every time you feel like, oh man, I could have done this better, that's what leads you to write a whole new play? I suppose that's good.
Well, when I was forced to write a play, right? So there, that, you know, you're writing your artistic statement, figuring out what it is that you do.
And your artistic statement is what? Your personal mission?
If you submit to, a high-profile play festival or, like, they have a ton of, like, grad student development grants that you can win, stuff like that. They want to know what you're after. What drives you to write? So you always have to submit an artistic statement with your play so that they can read what you think you do and how that comes out in your writing.
Oh.
So us having to do that all the time did way more, because I don't submit anymore. It's just, that's a full-time job. But the best example I have is my, oddly enough, it was a retirement home play. And I just kept writing about, like, because my grandma was in the retirement home, and I never write about anything that's just straight up funny. And I've known that for a long time. Like, I would never, like, write just funny characters in a nursing home, because you would end up making fun of old people.
Right.
Right.
So I just keep writing and writing and writing. It took the whole year, and I finally figured out, like, this whole play was about a girl coming back from New York, and she wrote a letter to her grandmother that she was coming back and that she was going to dye her hair pink, and we're going to do what we did when I was 14 years old or whatever, right? And so she writes this letter, and the whole play takes place with the grandmother, who's super excited, super proud, and really cranky because she wants everything to be perfect for her daughter to visit. And then, or her granddaughter, and her granddaughter never shows up. And so I've been, like, sort of writing this thing over and over, and then it hit me. I was like, when I was home on break, I was going to go visit my grandmother, and I told her I was, and I didn't. And for however I blocked that out, for my emotional purposes, I don't know, but it hit me like a ton of bricks. And it just, like, that process is what I know that I do. So I could never sit down and say, I'm going to write a play about a grandmother who's waiting on, you know, I could never do that. I wrote the characters for forever. And
So you pull like a story idea from what seems like the ether, and then just kind of work it over until you sort of, like, find out. That's a really great method to write. So, like, it's to discover why you're writing something while you're writing it, I think, is, like, a really great idea, because it's a good way, I mean, not even just to create something, I think that's a good way to, like, help yourself heal? I don't know, like, help yourself, like, kind of understand yourself a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
So you had, so, like, that sort of, is that something that you think the audience, in this case, your grandmother, picks up on?
That's terrifying, but also, but also I follow that terrifying feeling a lot of times.
Sure.
I read a quote that I've used that I always remind myself, like, and it's a little dramatic, but I still use it. if what you're putting on stage is not, wait, it's if you're not putting your career on the line every time you put something on stage, it's not worth doing.
That's great.
And so I always make sure that, because honestly, and Harold Pinter said this, he said, a truly good play makes everybody in the audience feel less alone. Because when you explore your worst moment, everybody's had a worst moment, and they'll be able to look at you and say, oh, you're fucked up, yeah. Right? And that happens all the time. They're like, dude, you are fucked up. That was hilarious. Well, guess what? You only laugh at things you relate to. So who are you?
Yeah.
And I don't think that. I'm happy when things go well. But
but if they harass you, then exactly.
Yeah.
It's like, you only got this because you're a shitbag too, guy. Like, come on.
Yeah.
Is the catharsis a drive for you at this point?
That's a good question. I certainly don't frame it like that in my mind.
Sure. I mean, because then it's a selfish endeavor.
If somebody else defines me as that, maybe. I don't know. But I looked at that play as a tribute to my grandmother.
Sure, yeah.
You know?
It's more exploratory than anything.
And to your point about, like, discovering it as you're writing it, I think one of the most important things to me to watch on stage is to know that characters are discovering things at the same rate as the audience. It keeps us very, very present, as opposed to having a plot, which in movies it works, right? The bad guy knew the whole time or whatever.
Yeah.
But on stage, when everybody's discovering things at the same time, which I've only been able to accomplish that as I discover it as I'm writing, right? So presence generally just, you don't have a choice but to watch, you know?
Sure.
You don't. If things are relating to you and discovering themselves in front of you, there's absolutely, I mean, it's in our DNA. We cannot look away. But people get in trouble when they want to be really complicated with plot and the writer writing about writing and things like that. Like,
yeah.
Like, if everything happens in the past or you're getting ready for something in the future, what happened to you stubbing your toe on the couch? Because I'll bet you in that moment you were not thinking about your brother's baggage or like whatever's going to happen at Thanksgiving, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Like that moment is the only thing you have access to right now because it's visceral in it, you know?
Yeah.
So that's a big driver for me too.
Is that something you find like with the majority of the pieces that you write and the plays that you write, like you like work it over until you like find out why you even started in the first place, or
now I do. Yeah. Since the artistic statement stuff.
Yeah.
Now I realize like when you sit down to write a play, the worst thing that I can do to myself is have expectations. Because this thing is either going to take a year or sometimes it takes 4 months.
Right.
You know? And if I have expectations about that, generally, I'm falling into the trap that I think happened at grad school, which is when intrusion has to come on page 10 and you have to have this final decision at the top of the tower where he's proposing to the woman who says no. How do you know that a character is going to make those decisions to end up on the tower proposing to a woman who says no? You have how long to get to that moment? And how many individual decisions is a character going to tell you as you're writing that it needs to make? You cannot plot it out. Some people can. Some people are very good at it. But
are you connected? Do you feel like the stories come to you from somewhere else? I mean, I guess a lot of it is born of, you know, you dealing with your own stuff. But you're saying, like, if the character tells me he needs to make this many decisions, do you feel like you're led on a path by the story? Or or are you, like you're saying, some people are into structure. I'm a structure person. Mm-hmm. I write a first draft immediately and just make decisions and then change those decisions. So I wonder.
Same process, different angle.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, sure. I mean, it's all.
But
at the end of the day, we're all making people hold paper in their hands and say words that we wrote. So.
Yeah.
Exactly.
But it's interesting to hear you go about it. You said that you went to grad school for playwriting, and you talked about you did a sketch and whatnot before you even got to Second City. Have you, what made you come back to that short form.
To sketch?
Yeah. I mean, sketch being like 3 minutes versus... I mean, I guess writing a 5-minute play is the same as writing a sketch.
Exactly the same.
And so you are like the king of it, huh?
I was so ready to do that. Like, right off the bat, I could tell nobody else had... I mean, it's just a different world when you come from sketch writing. And I had written, I don't know how many sketches before I got to grad school. And which also, like, as an improviser and as performers and, like, all that stuff, too, you understand stage presence. You understand the importance of keeping things theatrical and not just talking. Like, all these things. That's a little part of me. But I was 32 when I went, too. So it's like, you know.
You were already more advanced than a lot of the people that were in it. Or were most of the other people in the grad program in their 30s?
Well, yeah, most of them.
Yeah.
There were, one guy was like 55.
Yeah, hell, you're selling it hard to me. I'm all like, this is great, let me go.
Oh, but, it is wonderful.
Man, it's going to be great.
There's nothing like going from a shit ton of responsibilities to your only responsibility is writing, and we're going to raise the stakes on that. So, I'm not saying it was easier on me emotionally, because it wasn't.
No.
But there is something that tells you if you're a writer or not.
Yeah. It's so exciting.
Mm-hmm.
Man, what an experience.
So, you said, just to kind of move forward in your timeline, did you say that you had tried out in New York for a little bit, and that wasn't like...
So, I was telling her, so... the year between my first and my either my first and second year, so the summer I stayed in Athens just for whatever reason. I wanted a simple life and I wanted to live there when it was quiet, and that was really great. I decided with there was a guy who had moved. He was in the directing program, and he moved to New York, and he was like, and somebody passed him my play, and he was like, hey dude, do you want to do a play here? And I was like, yeah dude, of course. And then so we got people together to do it, and we spent about a month in New York. And that I was at a job interview like 2 years ago, and the interviewer was like, tell me about a time that you failed. And I was like, I raised a bunch of money. I brought a bunch of friends to New York. We put on this play and it was terrible. And I feel like I failed there. Yeah.
Was it because the audience wasn't big, or was it because people didn't like write you a review in the New York Times, or I mean, like, what was it?
Like, it was objection. Like, it was objectively terrible. Or
things.
Did you feel like the writing you put forth was not the best? What part of it?
I certainly,
if you don't mind us talking about it.
Absolutely. I took a play that was very personal and once again super dark and explored like family dynamics or whatever, and I certainly made it worse. I tried to revise and revise and revise. It went up to 200 pages, and then it went back down to like 150, and then it went... And by the time it was done and we were all rehearsing and the lead actor had dropped out, I had to go in. I could not memorize the lines. I just couldn't. I don't know why. I tried and tried and tried to the point where they were like, come on, let's run lines. I'm like, you know, I don't know the lines. I don't want to run these lines. It just makes me feel like shit. And things just didn't, it was not a professional experience. Things fell out. There were too many holes in the boat. People weren't happy with it. And I felt like too many people invested way too much money coming to New York to do what we did. We did get, I mean, every once in a while we got a decent audience, but the house wasn't that big. I mean, it was probably like 40 seats or something, but
Solid black box.
Did you feel like a lot of pressure in this being like a big time New York stage play or something?
No.
To the extent of like, well, where did all like the rewrites and stuff come from? Was this like
trying to figure out the end?
Okay.
And then we started getting a few cooks in the kitchen, and which I invited, but just didn't go well.
You don't necessarily like place that blame on yourself, though, right?
Yeah. I mean, I wrote it in many ways. I had to direct a lot of things. I raised the money for it. I ended up being in it. And there were times when the lead actress was like, I'm not sure I can do that scene when you don't. You just improvise. And I'm like, yeah, I know. I'm sorry. I wish I had an answer for you, but...
How short notice did the guy quit, though? I mean, there's nothing to be done.
Like
this does not sound like...
extenuating circumstances.
This does not sound like that could be your fault at all. I'm like, the idea that you were like, listen, even though I had to randomly take over the lead role, I couldn't do it immediately, doesn't sound like your fault.
Yeah, no.
Sounds a lot like that guy's fault.
I understand, like, taking it on to yourself, too, but, like...
It's because I've done enough performance where I felt like I should be able to handle this.
Yeah.
And I could not. I had, and to my defense, I had 4 days to learn the lines. And
yeah, that's crazy.
He had a shit ton of lines. and several monologues. And,
yeah, I mean, 4 days. Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
I can't imagine. It doesn't sound like it was really your fault.
Actors do it all the time.
Yeah, but you weren't an actor, and you didn't sign up as an actor, and you weren't in the mindset. I truly believe...
We lost two leads. I just remembered.
I mean,
what?
One person dropped out the week before, and then I got this other guy, which is another reason why I kind of blame myself. I pulled an improviser who just... He was like, we were trying to do read-throughs, and I'm not shitting you. He was like, and he was like, hi, and like, he did like Cowboys on the Moon, and he just.
Too many bits.
Oh, so many bits. And everyone was like, and then the director was finally like, hey, we got to start getting realistic here. You're going to have to suit up.
Yeah, you know, the interesting thing, though, is that play, the world that is, plays and theater is very different than the comedy world.
Very, very different.
Like, anytime I talk to somebody who is in the comedy world who's like, yeah, I think I might do some plays, I'm like, okay, but take it super seriously because they do, and you can't disrespect them or you'll never be able to play in their games. Like, you can't just swing in there and be all like, what's up? Totally cool. I'm living in the moment. How's it going? No.
I tried that.
Nope. Yeah, it's really different.
The world.
I mean, I totally understand. I came from a theater plays background as well, but I don't know. The idea of going from playwright to actor sounds insane in that world. I mean, that's so wild. So I wouldn't put it all on yourself. Is there any, to flip it a little, is there any like lesson of, that you take that you now use? 'Cause you've produced a lot since then. So like, are there any things that you took from that experience that like have made your later productions better?
Yeah. One thing that well, first of all, choosing the people very, very, have high standards.
Yeah.
For people, as opposed to performers. And I have proven that to myself over and over since then. I think that I'm just now, at this point, I just want to be director. I don't like handing things over to people anymore. That being said, there are definitely people I would hand things over to, for sure. But for now, I don't do props anymore. I just can't do props. I love committing to the moment and doing insanely, like, detailed object work. Because props are... Every time I have that ping of paranoia when... Did I grab the belt?
Yeah.
Because the belt comes off.
Yeah.
And, you know, and you don't have to do that if you just commit to the object work. And people... It's been 3 years now I just won't do props. Unless it's, like, a gun. I just did Frontera Fest, and they pulled guns out, and those were the only props. But,
well, that's kind of like, that also assists the audience in, like, getting there with you mm-hmm. as well. I think, like, that, because you were talking about the value of an audience kind of discovering something as the characters do, I think, like, audiences will pay more attention if they have to, if they have to do any of the mental work on stage.
Yeah, totally.
So, I totally get the value of, like, not making it super easy for them to, like, have to, or to be able to understand what's going on stage unless they are entirely engaged. So, yeah, mm-hmm. I get that. And also, Amy has always done, like, all the prop work and carrying for every, like, sketch show that the neighborhood has done. And it's, like, I've had to do other shows, and it's, like, where I would have to, like, make a prop and bring it. And I've forgotten it and wanted to just throw myself.
Yep.
In the lake, you know, just like just wanted to die over it. And
I've recently wanted to switch over to no props just because a week ago I took the neighborhood to the hideout shit hit the fan. I wasn't sure what was going on, so I immediately was like, I need to find a new space. This show matters to me. It's gonna happen. And it's just a very different space. And they have their, like, backstage nooks and crannies are just different. So I was like, yeah, when we do the show again, because we're doing it again in March, it's like, yeah, we're doing it with much fewer props because the idea of trying to stash them and figure it out was like, wait, what? Where is the next thing? So I was like, no, we don't need props to make jokes.
But when I, yes, okay. But yeah. When I... The more I get to know you, the more I feel like you're a person who can lay out a plot and execute it. Its own type of organizational, like, skill that you have.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like maybe you don't necessarily, tell me if I'm wrong.
Sure.
Do you not stress out about having props in the right place?
Oh, I mean, sure, I try my best to insist that jokes don't rely on them, because, yeah, I've had failures constantly.
Not that.
I've had years of failures.
What about, like, the organizational anxiety before a show? Do you have that about props? Or...
Oh, I mean, yeah, I guess. I always have, so many of them that I don't, I organize early on what we need and how much of it I have to bring in, and then the rest of it I go, all right, if you want that prop, get it.
Yeah.
And okay. If you want me to buy it, give me the money, because I don't have money.
And that also comes, like, with the way the neighborhood is set up, like, it's several different writers, so, like, you know, you're kind of put into the position of, like, hey, if you feel like that prop is super necessary, then yeah.
You gotta do it.
Bring get it yourself.
Yeah. Totally.
I mean, and I've had people who have written really elaborate prop scenes, and then they provide everything, so,
yeah, like, I've written,
hey,
like,
if you're going to do it, mm-hmm. go for it. I just think that props require a lot in order to make them worth it. Like, about a year ago, Nathaniel and Zach did True West at the theater.
I saw it.
Awesome. It was so essential to have the props for that show. That show was enormously reliant on having that physical space look the way that it did, and the physical space of the room changed as the play changed. It was like an example of it. Now, in that case, I was so for the realism of it. We worked so hard to put that in and out, to take it in and out of that space every night, even when we rehearsed, because we rehearsed for 2 weeks every day during the day. Jesus Christ. We would put the whole thing in And then we would rehearse, and then by like 4, we had to start clearing it out so that by 6, when people showed up for classes and shows, our stuff wasn't everywhere, right? But it was so necessary because it was like, it was deeply connected to all of it. Even I was in the show for 5 minutes total. I'm being generous. 2.5 minutes.
I remember very clearly your
part. But I felt strongly about the props, even the what I brought in. Like, I was like, oh, no, I need two bags. And they're like, are you sure? And I was like, I really do. I really do. I feel it. You know, and it made it better for me. You know what I mean? So it was like, yeah, sometimes props really mean something. And I'm neurotic. I started, the reason why I'm okay with that, lists of props and stuff, is that when I started doing plays, when I got a theater degree and then I got my first job, it was as a stage manager. Oh. So I was a stage manager for 5 years.
Thank you.
5 years after graduating from college, I worked as a professional stage manager. So that was my job.
The angels of theater.
Truly, truly.
Like,
100%. And I couldn't be an angel my whole life. Which is why I stopped. I could be a rich angel right now, but yeah. I'm not. Because I was like, yeah, I need to do other stuff. I love poverty. No, I just really, you know, I wanted to be artistic. I wanted to write. I wanted to perform, you know. But I think each one of them are different. So right now you're focusing, you said, on directing. Have you written recently? Have you been still continuously writing?
Now, God, when you have the release of like not having all that shit, right? So I walked out of there, grad school, with shit I should be working on for the next 10 years. I mean, I have enough now where I know what's been tested, what's not good, what excited me the most. So I wanted to do that. That was my goal. Then I got out, and I've just been, like, I write a one-act play every time from TerraFest. That's just a really great once-a-year thing, and it's made writing so pleasant. Me and my buddy wrote a full-length play for the Long Fringe Frontera Fest, and that was fun. But as far as, like, directing goes, it's kind of secondary, other than the fact that my biggest thing right now, I just love teaching. I just like teaching.
Yeah.
The itch of writing and performing comes up. Writing is a little stronger for me than performing. So it is very fun, and I loved, like, this last process with Ariel, Virgil, and Catherine. So I had the bones of a play, and I knew, like, the moment that I wanted to hit in it. And then I had maybe 15 pages, and then we just got together for, I think it was like a month, a little over a month. And I let them improvise. I pushed it where I wanted it to go, and I directed very heavily on the improv. But those two muscles are coming together in the most pleasant way for me. Like, directing improv, writing, and making sure that everybody in the room has ownership. It was amazing. The play was fantastic in Frontera Fest, but it was like 3 minutes too long, and they cut us off, and it was one of the worst experiences I've ever had.
Oh, wow. I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
That's hard. Yeah, they have a hard out with those things. And those festivals, they run you tight.
They have to.
They
do 80 plays in like 5 weeks. So
right?
Like,
yeah.
People are traveling with their pickup truck with full of props, and
another reason not to have props.
And they show up and it's like, I can't imagine what you deal with. So I do understand that. But she didn't have to walk up to me in the audience. show me her phone and go.
For the listeners out there, he just ran his thumb across his neck.
Ooh.
I love Christy to death. Do you know Christy Moore?
No.
She runs Frontera Fest. She does script works, which, by the way, do you know script works? It is such a... You got to get involved. It is such a supportive playwrights group. They hand out commissions. You can, like... There's, like, a steady submission form that is always updated. You pay $40 for the year, and you can write a play and have it read by really good actors. But anyway, so she's... I've always loved her. And then she came up and did the throat thing, and I still love her to death.
Was she trying to make a joke? Was she trying to be funny? No, she was like, how dare you go over 20 minutes?
Right. Well, 25. And, once again, totally understand why you have to do that. Not only that, they tell us that at least 10 times before you get on stage. So it's not like it was a surprise.
Yeah.
But...
I can't even imagine what it's like to run a festival like that, though.
Wow. Yeah, yeah.
No, I mean, there's no comparison to it.
I think about the, like, level of organization. Like, you talking about the neighborhood. Like, that's as much as I can do. I could not do a festival. Absolutely not. Oh, no.
I mean, it is literally the most impressive festival I've ever been a part of.
Yeah.
By far. And for any of those listeners out there who are writers, get involved with script works. It is the best thing you can do. It was like the first thing I did when I got to Austin. I went to, they had a meet and greet, just luckily on the day I arrived here. And I went there and I met Will Cleveland. And Will took me to the Institute, Will and Amber took me to the institution. We ended up doing improv and I was like, hey, new friends. And I thought, you know, this was my rhythm. This was my city rhythm for sure.
Huh.
That's awesome. I love Will. He's great.
Do you think the experience that you, since you learned a lot at Second City, do you think that style of writing lends itself to the writing you were talking about where you had like a framework and then you improvised to flesh it out? Because from what I understand, because I don't 100% know all about the Second City method, from what I understand, there's a lot of writing from improv. So I wondered if perhaps the skills learned there are a lot of what helped that process.
I think it depends on who's directing the main stage. But if you go into classes at Second City, there's setup, they don't call it an intrusion. What's the other word for it?
Rising action?
The throwing off of the world.
I see what you're saying.
There's
I don't know
term,
what the word.
I forget. It's essentially the intrusion. So there's the setup, the intrusion, first turning point, second turning point, resolution. And that's how you write there. And they've got a factory going, so, you know, they need to scale everything. That's why it isn't what it once was. But at the same time, I think main stage, main stage is done through improv. But they put up so many shows that, like, for traveling groups, from what I understand, they do a lot of classic sketches. So they do stuff that's, you know, worked for a long time.
Yeah.
And they get to write a little bit, I guess, but, you know.
Interesting. So it's kind of like the Esther's Follies model. Take a sketch, keep doing it forever.
Mm-hmm.
It's totally fine. Keep it going.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Main stage is always fresh.
Sure.
But they run it forever.
Yeah.
ETC is the same way. But improv, I mean, like, at some point they probably taught that method, but now it's like... writing, improv for actors, improv for older actors, and there's like 9 million different ways to cash in on it. And then IO is just purely improv. They have like enough people there to where they'll hold specialty workshops or like series of workshops. Annoyance, I think, is the closest thing to where it's really super supportive towards that type of development.
Huh.
Because, and their shows, like, I've seen really good shows there, and I've seen really, really shitty shows there, which is also the beauty of it. But Mick Napier, he's the guy that is just, he's the improv to sketch king.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I had only learned about it because of Kevin McDonald from Kids in the Hall. When he came, he did stuff at Second City Toronto, and he was always, his point is always, you know, write a first draft and then improvise it and flesh it out like that. Mm-hmm. Or let's do some improv and get some ideas and build it from that. So that's a lot of the process that I had taken a couple workshops with him, and then he and I, he's been a friend since the first time I took the workshop from him. So like sometimes I'll, when I'm hitting a wall, I'll be like, what's, oh God,
yeah,
I can't write anything. What can I do? And he'll go, try this thing. And I'll go, okay, thanks. Very helpful.
Yeah.
But yeah, I wondered what your experience of it was. And so when you came down here and you met Will and you did, improv at the institution, how did you get involved with, like you met Will and then you ended up going to, well, you went to script works first. You met Will, you found about, there was some improv in town. What's been your, how many years have you been here and what's been your journey so thus far in the community?
So I graduated in 2014. So I probably got here. When do you graduate? What's the month?
Like May?
May? Yeah, May. So I think I stayed there for a month or something. And then I moved here. So May, I'm terrible with these.
Like June or July?
Yeah, let's just call it June or July. So I got here and met Will. Institution. I was really hot on wanting to turn short plays into movies.
Mm-hmm.
That was a big reason I came here. And I was LA, 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 LA the whole time I was at school. All my friends made a mass exodus out to LA from Chicago. So that was what I was going to do. And then I just wasn't convinced everyone was happy and that it was going to be a healthy decision for me. So I didn't know a single person in Austin. I didn't know a single, that's kind of why I moved here. And it probably had a lot to do with the complexity of living in a small place for a long time.
Yeah.
I moved here and then I went to the New Movement really early, but I did script works, and I think I was just trying to figure out how to produce plays.
Yeah.
I just wanted to get a play up. And I moved in with, I found him on Craigslist, but do you know
Craigslist Jack? Pretty random.
Yeah, that's about as random as
it. Jack Leahy, do you know him? He's
sounds a full-time familiar
person. And then Daniel Berkowitz and Eli Edson. Okay. So they were all improvisers. They're Coal Town people. Or Daniel's not, but... So I had the familiarity of, you know, the type of people that I get along with.
So those were your roommates when you first moved to town?
Mm-hmm.
Good.
And they were super great to me.
I mean, as far as randomly goes, that... yeah. That's nice.
Yeah, for real.
Randomly on Craigslist normally means, like, you lose a limb or a kidney or something.
Yeah.
So.
Yep.
Yeah, I've had a lot of randomlies on Craigslist.
Random.
Yeah. Whew. Yeah, I've gotten a lot of random weird crap off of Craigslist. So yeah, you won there. That
I
sounds
did.
Pretty great.
I scored.
And then you're still friends with them, and you still chat with them, even though clearly they're not your roommates anymore, unless your wife's really cool with having a bunch of roommates.
Yeah, you know, like a Partridge Family situation going on.
No, that wouldn't. No. So then I went to the New Movement. I went to Coal Town. I did hideouts. And because I did so much, so the part of the most important thing that happened at Ohio was that I was able to figure out my own style of teaching and my own format and my own path for improv, because I took over the, I started directing the improv kids there. So much talent. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. The first person I met there, I was introduced to the person who was kind of like, he was still in like a junior in college there. Luke Knoll, who is now on SNL as a featured cast member.
Nice.
Yeah. Like, and then there's this other improviser. She is in tons of movies, and she was featured in Rolling Stone, and she's like blowing up as a comedian and an actress.
You can drop that name if you want to.
Patty Harrison.
All right.
It's wonderful to see people that you work with do well, especially when you know that they're good people.
Mm-hmm.
Like, one of the earlier things you said was, I learned to work with good human beings. And I feel like, even if I hadn't learned it myself from my own creating of plays like you, just watching people that I'd known over the years, the people who are nice to me are still doing it. The people who are jerks to me, I haven't seen their names since that time. Absolutely. Like, it's like the people who were kind would speak to every level. Because I was a stage manager for years. If you talk to the stage manager, like, you were lowering yourself sometimes, you know? So, like, people would treat me like crap. Everywhere. I mean, and I worked for NYU. I didn't like work for Broadway. I worked for NYU. I was a like 20-year-old working for grad students.
Mm-hmm.
And they would treat me like they were friggin' Oscar winners and I was a peon. And I was like, relax. You're doing fucking Midsummer Night's Dream at NYU. Get over your life.
Stage
like, come on.
Fall for no reason.
Like, yeah, I'm in charge of that shit.
Yeah.
You want your prop or what?
Yeah.
Anyway, the nice before. People are still doing stuff. You know, they're out there doing things. And then the people who were jerks to me, I'm like, oh, isn't that interesting? Aren't you unemployed? Isn't that funny for you? Yeah, people, it comes around.
Yeah, and that kind of goes all the way back to what we were talking about being good people. And this is something you can instill in your child. Is like,
sure.
It's very Star Wars to say it, but it's like a fast way to sort of shoot up to the top of what you can see in, you know, in your, like, narrow scope as a young person. But, like, eventually everybody gets really tired of that shit, and it all just kind of peters out, you know? Like in Star Wars, the dark side is a quick way to become powerful, but in the end it's very self-destructive. Whereas, like, the light side... Again, make your kid watch Star Wars. I'm sure Chris is on this. I want to drag you back to a moment
where I asked you if your life is a journey, is it a melodrama? And you kind of just
I know what I'm doing. Star Wars happens to be the first thing. I could do this with every other thing you've ever heard of.
Oh my God, are you kidding
me? I could literally compare myself to Goku or Frodo or Bilbo. I could do this all day.
Melodrama. Okay. Let's do Schindler's List.
Oh, God! Why would you do that?
You don't have to do it.
Why?
Can I be Oscar Schindler and the Jewish people?
Oh, God!
I'm sorry.
This was going to end so well.
Can my own happiness be the... No, it's fine. It's really funny is... Not really funny. That's not... Not really funny. Interestingly enough.
I love how I get to dig a hole and you get to fall in with a shovel.
And just keep going. I'm just so glad you dug me a hole that I'm even slightly familiar with.
Oh my God.
You gave me at least the minimal amount of ammo for me to just go, well, I know that story, and if you give me 3 minutes and another beer, I could probably do it, but nobody's going to be happy about it. Very much like the end of Schindler's List.
If you hadn't told me at the beginning of this that you hadn't listened to anything, hadn't listened to the episodes, I would have assumed that you had, because Wendell is always saying horrifying shit on this podcast.
Oh, really?
And the idea of him comparing his life to Schindler's List is very on brand for Yes But Why.
And I will say, I will say that we are getting very close to our 100th episode.
Yeah, we are.
And I have made leaps and strides. Like, I am all kinds of better from, like...
He is very rarely talking about pedophilia. Very rarely.
Very rarely.
Very rarely.
And that is through, you know, much effort on my end.
He is a strong man.
Have you guys downloaded the app?
What? I don't want to know. I don't know, what you're talking about. Please tell me it's not a pedophilia app. What are you talking about?
Is it a deepfake thing, or what?
Oh, God, now I need to know. What?
You can download an app that drops a pin for every sexual predator around you.
What?
It's not worth it. I did it, and it's very...
Just pins?
Wait. Yeah, it'll tell you... Up to what proximity level?
It'll tell you where they live.
Are you talking about, like...
No,
can you do it inside of, like, the bar you're standing in?
It's not like the stars.
That would be awesome, actually. You just use your phone to look around, and it's like, no.
Yeah,
no,
you just hold it up to somebody's face, and you're just like, ew.
It's pink.
Yeah.
Blinks at you.
So wait, that's, like, pretty much like the sex offender registry that you can just, like, look up? You can just have an app for that now and just know?
And if there's an app for that, at any point in time... You can look it up. The reason you don't want to do it...
You don't have to pull it up in this room right now. I'm not going to say why. Okay. No,
the reason you don't want to do it is because you were fine not knowing.
I live in a very large apartment complex, and I'm sure that would
guarantee
really
there are so many sex...
Because I never see anybody. I never see... it's one of the biggest apartment complexes in Austin. I don't ever see anybody walking around, and I got a feeling everybody's hiding. Something.
Right.
Everybody's hiding from something.
And I think it's because the only people I do see are kids out in the parking lot. Never hardly see any adults. I think that's because they have to stay indoors while the kids are in the parking
lot. Or maybe you block everything else out.
Ooh.
And you're...
pedophile.
All you see is kids. I think that's what you just told us.
Oh my God.
Man.
Oh my God.
I appreciate you putting up with me for this whole time, because I'm obviously having a weird mental breakdown. I really appreciate you wearing a beanie with a propeller and some overalls for this.
Look so perfect.
Always here with the lollipop.
Oopsie doopsie, I dropped my chocolate.
Oh no.
Oopsie doopsie.
No, I can't end this on a horrible, gross joke.
If I heard a kid say oopsie doopsie, I dropped my jawbreaker, I would think that kid was a cop. That would be, like, obviously.
You're right, yeah.
Oh,
like,
yeah,
that kid is
total bait.
That's like when a guy comes up to you and he's like, hey, do you have any of those marijuana cigarettes? It's 420, isn't it? You're like, oh, no, this guy's a cop. This is what's happening.
No,
like, what's going on?
I would like to say, for the record, you can rewind this, that I was not the impetus for this. I went with it because because polite conversation is necessary in a podcast.
Yep.
But I did not go this route.
You're right. You're right. You are.
I am obliging to my guest right now. And I gotta say, it's kind of nice that I'm not the one driving this, but we should...
I'm gonna be honest with you. I was wondering if we were gonna go down a weird rabbit hole, because I feel like... And I was like, this is not how I'm ending this thing, so I'm gonna ask you one more question, and then we're gonna wrap it up so this weird conversation is not the last thing we talk about.
I know, I bet my mom... Never mind, keep going.
So, our number one listener.
Yeah,
hi, Renee.
What if you had the sex addict app up and you were in your house at home? You saying, I doubt my mom would, and then you stopped. What if, like, you realized your mother's a sex offender?
I was just about to say, sex addict and sex offender are two very different things.
Did I say addicts first?
You did first.
Okay.
So I was going to be like, those are two different apps.
I mean, they can. That Venn diagram can come together.
Yeah, it's a Venn diagram for sure.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying, the ones outside of the offender list are having a good time.
But it could also be, like, people that like to pee outdoors in public, too. So, you know, like...
Yeah, that's,
like,
true.
You know,
that's true.
There's a crossover there.
I'm sorry.
You could be 17 and have a 16-year-old girlfriend and be on the sex offender list. You don't know.
Right.
So, with reference to deeply offensive material, I know that some of the comedy that you've done, like with Eggs and other groups, has pushed the, you know, pushed the limits a little bit.
We've
talked
about, like, a lot of the stuff that you've written being, you know, having that dark twist anyways. I was wondering, it didn't surprise me that this conversation took that turn anyways.
Yeah, but I heard, and you and I talked about a little bit of the Stapleface show, that it really pushed boundaries. Did you guys write that as a group? Were you part of the writing, or were you just directing it? Or was it all improv? How did that get developed, and how did you affect it?
That was 100% like any way it comes. Some people wrote sketches and brought them in, and then we would improvise the hell out of it. And a lot of it just came from, okay, let's do a scene where you're at the office and there's no more K-cups. And then somebody comes in, they're just like, no more K-cups. And then we just built on that. And that was so fun. Like,
that's specific
so
example.
Fun. That show.
Oh, yeah,
the,
yeah.
The show was, because we had zero expectations other than we're doing an hour-long show, and we did every different kind of dimension of, like, audience address. They did a show on Frontera Fest, and there's one scene. Did you see the show?
I didn't.
So there's, we do two short form games that are super dark, and one of them is like, okay, we're gonna play Freeze and Help, so could you give me a suggestion of your favorite childhood toy, anybody, your favorite childhood toy? And we're playing it like it's like, we're at Comedy Sports, and, you know, very like professional, and we're really proud of what we're doing. And then at Frontera Fest, perfect, the lady said pogo stick. He's like, pogo stick, okay, for a sense of scale, can you hand me a pogo stick? And tell me what color it was. She was like, it was silver, and it was orange, and I used to jump on it, and you go like this. And he's like, okay, so hand that to me. And then she, like, takes it, you know, and, like, really gets into it out of the audience, and she has to pass it up the audience, right? And then she gives it to Clayton. Clayton's like, okay, awesome. So when the lights come up, freeze and help. Lights come up, and he goes, and then the scene lasts for about 10 minutes, and it's just him shoving it up his ass in as realistic way as possible, and he's like, and then people freeze in, and they're either like sticking like a shoehorn in his ass, or spitting on his ass, or like doing all kinds of gross things. And then finally he sits down on a chair, and when he sits down, he's like, and by that time everybody in the audience is like, oh my god, this is so, and it's so visceral, right? It's halfway over, because he stands up and he's like, and people come out and try to help him puke it up. And then Kyle finally comes out and puts a fishing reel, like, line down his throat, and he's like, I got it. And then when he pulls it, Clayton's like going like that, and he's walking around the stage with him, and it's just, Clayton looks terrible, and he is literally exhausted by the end of it. He puked on stage trying to do it, one of the Stapleface shows. But so Kyle and everybody get back behind Kyle, and they're like, one, I think we caught ourselves an orange and silver pogo stick. And then they pull it out of him. He's like, ah! And you gotta hear it, because it's like, feels like it came out of him, right? So then Nikita comes over, and she picks it up, and she's like wringing it off and unhooks it. Ladies and gentlemen, freeze and help! And then she hands the pogo stick back to the front row so they can pass it back to the lady. And the lady was like, no. Take it. And then the lady who had the pogo stick was like, I'm not going to touch that. I'm sorry. I'm not going to touch that. And it was real. I mean, in my mind, it lasted like 2 minutes that she was arguing. And she said, she was like really offended. And she wouldn't take it. And the lady in the front felt like she was stuck holding this disgusting pogo stick.
That's awesome.
And that's why I think no props, like, can happen. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because they were disgusted, and she was like, what am I supposed to do with it? And then the lady once again was like, get it away from me! Get it away from me! And it was real.
Wow. Took somebody's childhood toy.
Yeah.
And shoved it up Clayton's ass. That's...
For 10 minutes. That's... Like, it was inched into his ass with, like, improv games, you know?
I love that. I love that so much.
Oh my god!
I love that so much.
You gotta watch Clayton do it. He's so real.
Yeah, he's pretty excellent, for sure.
He's also just one of the nice, like, most, like, the nicest, most positive dudes that I've ever met. Super, and just for him to, like, find that sort of dark place is always, like, it just shows, like, the sort of depth he has as a performer. And...
Oh, he's such a
performer. I mean, enough depth to shove a pogo stick, at least.
But also, like, the contrast, I mean, it is a really hard contrast to be... like super hokey short form improv, but also this is how we do it, and it's gonna hurt me. Mm-hmm. So every time he would, you know, he'd have it like half up his ass, and people are trying to like help shove it up his ass, and his face is red and he's really in pain, and then somebody's like, freeze, and he's like, and then someone comes in and they put salad tongs in there and like open it up a little bit and then shove it up and then unfreeze him. And he's like, oh, and he would actually literally react to if salad tongs had opened up your anus enough to inch it in a little, a pogo step a little bit further. And he's like, oh my God, yeah. And he like, that actually helped me get around the handlebars a little bit. Thank you. You know? And the more detail, the better.
Yeah. Oh, man. Now, the audience is horrified at this point.
Yeah, they.
I have two questions. One question, I have so many questions. What are my two questions going to be? My first question is, were they angry and did they leave and or complain about the show?
Split down the middle, and this happened throughout the run as well. Some people did not like it. There were people who would leave. Because when you see someone, like, gagging, it's kind of contagious.
Yeah, yeah. Sure.
So there were things like that. But there were also, like, really nasty things that were said in the show. So, yes, a crowd like Frontera Fest is not ready for that. And we all knew that walking in. But we knew that we would get some, we would win some lifetime admirers as well. And there were some people who were like, holy shit, that show was fantastic, you know? But most people exhausted their nervous laughter within the first 2 minutes of that scene.
My other question is, how did the festival take it? Do they just go, it doesn't matter what happens?
It's fringe.
That's it. They're just like, you like it, you don't. It's fringe.
Fringe.
So, like, they didn't, like, call you later and go, like, listen, you can't be bringing that here.
Nope.
They're just like, no, nope, some people liked it, some people didn't. That's just the way of the world. Yep. Man.
A pogo stick would have been helpful in, like, a Schindler's List sort of scenario.
Oh, boy, oh, boy.
no, that's a... Hey, like, yeah, this didn't... This didn't get brighter after we stopped talking about Schindler's List.
I feel...
This didn't,
no, you're
like,
right.
Lighten up.
No,
it's not like we went from, like, Schindler's List to, like...
But stuffing a pogo... An improv pogo stick up your ass and then puking it out is, like, an artistic discussion we can have.
Yeah,
if you want to talk about how they made the movie Schindler's List, sure, I'll talk about it. But it's, like... The topic of the movie has no association with what our conversation is.
That's your hero's journey through life.
Absolutely. Yeah,
oh, my God.
Yeah. Those fences were only, like... I'm just saying, pogo sticks back in the day. This has been so fun.
Yeah.
I want to say this has been so fun. This has been a big box of chocolates for me.
Yeah.
And I've eaten more Twizzlers right now than in my entire life. I just want to say that right now. I have
really?
More
you
red
did the,
wax inside of
you
me.
You did the pizza thing where you, I felt like you were folding it and then eating the fold.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, because I don't know,
I just got the candy because it's Valentine's. Also, we hadn't had, Wendell, you and I hadn't had candy together for a while, yeah, so I was like, let's have some sweets.
I don't think Twizzlers when I think Valentine's Day, which, you know, that's my birthday. In a week.
Yeah.
I'm fucking 30 years old.
Don't, you're, we're both older than you.
I know, nothing to this audience right now.
No, absolutely not. I'm going to be 40 this year.
Me too.
This year is good.
August 31st.
Oh, interesting. Really? Mm-hmm. Interesting. My husband's birthday is August 28th.
Cool.
Yeah. Weird.
Are we both? Yeah, we're both Virgos.
Uh-huh.
Leo's the September 1st or something, right?
I don't know.
I don't know. Don't care.
Yeah, I didn't know. I've never been into astrology. Yeah, because I'm a Cancer, and so I decided that was not a system I needed to be part of. I was like, thanks, I'm out.
It's like, all right, I'm a Cancer, but I bet the symbol for that's pretty cool. That's just a crap.
Yeah, it's a crap. Like, and then they're like, well, I'm sure really what it means is cool. And then it's like, you're a sappy woman and you fucking wipe up your vagina. And that's what it says. And I'm like, ugh, forget it.
There's a bull over there. I can't be a bull.
Yeah, I know. Could I be something else? Could I be like a yin-yang or something? Jesus Christ.
I've had a really good time with this. This has been fun. I just want to say that. I might be the
Me
only
too.
One.
I had a great time.
Thanks. Yeah, no, thanks I was going to say.
What were you going to say?
I was going to say, I'm not sure, but it was going to be something shitty about yin yang.
All right. Yeah, no, I feel like something shitty about yin yang is a good hashtag to drop off on.
Hashtag something shitty about yin yang. All right. Thank you so much, Anthony, for
Thanks
sitting
for
with
having
us.
Me.
And I don't know if we ever said your name the whole time.
I did. I said it a couple times.
Okay. Just wanted, like, Anthony, we said the full name.
I didn't say his full name, right. Anthony Ellison.
Anthony Ellison. You think it's Anthony Richard because on Facebook, I don't want people to.
And also, that's the Google Calendar notification that I got.
Is it?
I just made it from the Facebook.
And also, that helps me research anybody I haven't met yet.
So. I just made it that way because we've had guests who have stage names and stuff, and so I don't assume anything about anyone's name until I come and ask you. And so I just communicate to Wendell the information I've been given. So if it's like, you know, Two-Step Tammy, I go, we're having an interview with Two-Step Tammy. But then she says, oh, no, my official name is Elizabeth Robertson. You're like, okay.
And
I don't know.
Then don't have a stage name.
No, if I get a Two-Step Tammy, I'm not looking that shit up. I'm just going in blind because that sounds
Two-Step Tammy,
I'm going in 100% in the dark because I can learn everything about Two-Step Tammy.
Well, also, the other thing about writers, because you're a writer, is isn't it similar, because I don't know this, if you join the Writers Guild, isn't it similar to the Screen Actors Guild, where you can't have the same name as somebody else?
Totally. But that rule has been... That rule has turned into, like, a cool thing. Because I know so many people who now... Just they either want to go with all three names, which is fine for all of you writers out there, but there are a lot of playwrights who are like, my name's Richard Anthony Ellison, thank you.
Yeah, no. I'm good. I mean, you have a lovely name. I'm just saying my personal three name. No, thank you.
What is it?
I mean, now I'm married, so my last name is Jordan, but my middle name is Jean. I mean, it's Amy Jean Jordan.
Amy Jean Jordan is
that
awesome.
Like,
get out of here.
That sounds like a duo.
No.
See, that doesn't sound like a... Amy. That doesn't sound like an
Amy
uppity
Jean
playwright's
Jordan.
Name.
Yeah. I'm seriously...
Amy
I can
Jean
already,
Jordan.
I can already hear the song about you dying in a, like, race of chicken or something, like
That's
in the 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah, like...
I died in the 50s in a race with chicken.
In a race with chickens? Ugh.
She thought being a human would make her win, but it didn't work out.
She challenged the one chicken in her high school.
All right, good night.
Out the high school. Everybody, thank you so much. Michelle, marry me.
Yeah, there you
Take
go.
Take care.
Goodbye.
Hey, thanks for listening to the Yes But Why podcast.